04-17-15, 04-17-16, 04-17-17, 04-17-19, In Re Copper Ante Trust, ASARCO Incorporated versus J.P. Morgan and Company. Mr. Weinstein, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
I'm going to be addressing this morning, Your Honors. It is still barely morning. The issues that cover all of the appellants. Mr. Wasmuth will follow addressing issues that are specific to Southwire, which case has some specific issues that are in addition to those that are common to the appeals. I'm going to address primarily the question of the class action tolling of Heliotrope and the issue of equitable estoppel. If the court has some specific questions about the class action tolling of the Loeb case, I obviously will address that, but I do not intend to devote much of my 10.5 minutes to that specific issue.
Could I just clarify one thing on the 2 points that you do, actually on the second of the 2 points that you are going to be addressing, namely the equitable estoppel. Appellee Sumitomo has made the point that this is not an issue that pertains to them. I take it you agree with that.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, so that's only Morgan. Okay, fine.
Mr. Wasmuth will address all of the issues relating to Sumitomo because they are not a defendant in the ASARCO cases.
Okay.
Rather, what we have here is a situation with respect to class action tolling in the Heliotrope case where the same exact conspiracy, the exact same evidence, the exact same memories, the exact same witnesses are involved in both the class action in Heliotrope and these individual actions brought by ASARCO and the other plaintiffs.
Let me just start out by asking you as simplistic a question as anyone could ask you, and it is this. How is it that a team of lawyers from several different sophisticated firms working for seven or more large companies would fail to immediately conclude that they should investigate whether financial supporters of Sumitomo could be on the hook for antitrust claims?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is that we are Monday morning quarterbacking now, looking back at the atmosphere in 1996, 97, 98, and 99. The answer to it is that the environment at that time was, especially in light of the efforts, the deliberate efforts of J.P. Morgan, the environment was that Sumitomo had a rogue trader that was acting, who was acting without authority even of the Sumitomo Corporation. That was the story as it broke, and Sumitomo was the one that broke the story. Throughout those 3 years, J.P. Morgan, in various contexts, at various opportunities, took the position that all it did was do what banks do, which is to lend money. They don't have, their position was throughout that they were not governing what it was that Sumitomo, that's say Mr. Hamanaka at Sumitomo, was doing with the money.
Now, Mr. Weinstein, am I correct that not only in your cases, but actually in no one's cases, did anyone bring Morgan into this package of litigation until after the August 13th, 1999 unveiling of the Sumitomo case?
Virtually correct. There are two exceptions.
Okay.
There is Sumitomo itself.
Right.
Sumitomo
right.
had access through confidentiality agreements that it had with Morgan to gain access to Morgan's documents, and it was on the basis of the information developed internally at Sumitomo and with that access that was access without compulsory process in terms of our having access to it.
Morgan said is we didn't do it. We're not guilty. Isn't that about the size of it?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, that is not what they said. On the contrary, in their brief, even on appeal now, on page 25, they say, I'm reading, quoting it. Morgan would clarify the facts as it understood them when incorrect information was published, and would provide guidance, I emphasize, provide guidance to the press, often off the record, when unfounded rumors were reported. Unfounded from their point of view. But the point is, they were not just saying, no, we didn't do it. They were providing guidance to the press. They went to the Wall Street Journal. You've seen that in the brief. I don't need to repeat all of the evidence.
There's no question they were very aggressive in their public information control, and that they made a concerted effort, certainly, to keep information about, you know, any connection to Sumitomo's bad acts hidden from the public. Well, I'll give you that.
Well,
what about
it's more than that. Your Honor, I do want to come back to your question. I haven't finished answering it, but if I may, Judge Rogner, just to say, in addition to just denial, they went beyond mere denial. They fabricated statements. They made false statements to the regulators, understanding that that was going to affect the entire climate. And I said that there were two cases, Your Honor.
Right, there's Sumitomo's own case, which I
Sumitomo,
understand. That's what
and the other one is the futures class action in New York, where they had subpoena power, and they had to enter into standstill agreements, confidentiality agreements, and indeed their complaint, when they finally amended it, it's called the Fifth Amendment complaint, when they finally filed it, it was filed under seal. And that those confidentiality standstill agreements are the same ones that reflect Morgan's threat to the plaintiff's counsel in that litigation up until the time that the complaint got filed, that if they filed before the expiration of the standstill, they were facing Rule 11 sanctions motions by Morgan against them. In other words, even in that context, where they were producing documents because they were compelled to do so, but they were done under confidentiality, they were taking the position that you don't have a basis for an antitrust suit or any other kind of suit. In that instance, that case was a Commodity Exchange Act.
To what extent does your argument depend on the ability to distinguish between notice of something that might be an antitrust problem versus notice that perhaps poor banking practices are being used, or other things that deal with other kinds of legal problems?
I think that it's important. In this instance, there were items in the press prior to the unsealing of the Sumitomo complaint that indicated that, yes, they had some banking regulation problems with the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and the New York State Banking Department, but they had to do, apparently, with record-keeping issues, controls, internal banking controls. There was no suggestion anywhere that there was anything approaching a combination by Morgan with Sumitomo, in essence, the conspiracy to manipulate the copper futures market and the copper physical copper cathode market. And so the fact that you might have an awareness that there were banking regulation problems doesn't tell you anything about whether or not you have a Rule 11 basis for alleging that there was an intentional, and this court in the prior Loeb decision, Your Honor, knows, that intent to participate in the conspiracy is an essential part of alleging a cause of action under the Sherman Act. So the mere fact that people may have made mistakes in their banking controls and
stuff
internally.
Well, there was the public reprimand. I mean, there were some things out there that were singling Morgan out as an especially, let's say, notable figure in this copper problem.
Very little, but there was a leak of the memorandum of understanding that that Morgan entered into with the regulators. There's no question about that. We're not saying otherwise. But definitely, there was no notice that instead of being the mere banker who provided a lot of funding to a very large corporation, in fact, J.P. Morgan was an integral part of the conspiracy. Once Sumitomo let those facts out, and certainly they would know, then all of the other cases were filed of record, And that's at the time
when... That's when Morgan's name gets added in the form of amended complaint.
That's
out
correct.
In California and everywhere
else. The Doe Amendment first, and then
you didn't bring your suit till 93, though, right? Or 2003?
2003, yes. Your Honor, that is correct. Within the four-year statute of limitations, starting
barely.
From August 13th.
Barely, I say.
Well, yes, maybe. That's true. In fact, one of the plaintiffs in our group filed later than the others because it was in bankruptcy proceedings and required bankruptcy court approval. But all of that was done, and it was done within the statutory four-year period.
Are you aware of any cases where courts use the party's opt-out date as the date when tolling ceased?
I'm not sure I understood your question, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Are there any cases where a court has looked at the date that a party opted out and said that's when the tolling has ceased?
There are courts that have mentioned it. Whether, and I think Mr. Wasmuth will address that in connection with Southwire's situation.
Right.
In terms of our situation, if you look at the Asarto group of appellants, they opted out in March of 2003, Your Honor, and consequently filed within a period of less than 4 months, even for that later filing because of the bankruptcy court approval that was required.
You mentioned that you're going to address heliotrope. We haven't given you much of a chance to do that. But
thank you,
I have
Your
this
Honor.
Question. Assuming that heliotrope has a tolling of impact here, it only lasted for a little more than a year, didn't it? So what difference does it make whether heliotrope qualifies as a tolling action?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. Heliotrope had tolling effect from the time when the Doe Amendment was made in the early 2000, until the opt-out in 2003.
Now because that's case eventually... Heliotrope 2. I'm talking about Heliotrope 1, which...
Heliotrope 1, it is in the record... It is in the record that Heliotrope 1 was never dismissed, and the affidavit of the counsel for the plaintiff in that case establishes that even while the Heliotrope 2 was filed, if you're referring to the two cases that involved Morgan, then yes, that... Heliotrope 1 continued to be on the record.
But you seem to be saying that Morgan had noticed from Heliotrope 1 that it was involved somehow, even when it was still a John Doe party?
It ceased to be a John Doe party.
Well, I know eventually, but is that in time to help you?
Yes, Your Honor, because that was right after Sumitomo's suit became public.
Right, so, again, you're... Okay.
Right, so...
But the case law seems pretty clear that tolling ends when a trial court denies class certification, regardless of whether a matter is appealed, doesn't it?
There was no denial of class certification involving J.P. Morgan until after this litigation was commenced, because what happened was vis-a-vis Morgan, I see my time is...
I'm going to give you some time. Don't be nervous about that, any of you, you know.
Okay, I appreciate that, Your Honor. What happened was the denial of class certification in the original Heliotrope litigation involved defendants other than J.P. Morgan. It may implicate Sumitomo and Global, and that's what Mr. Wasmuth will address, but it did not involve J.P. Morgan because J.P. Morgan wasn't even named yet. The Doe Amendment to bring Morgan into the litigation occurred after all that was history. And at that point... The Doe Amendment is filed. The judge recognized that the principal original defendants had already settled out. And so for his convenience, he directed that a new complaint be filed against the new defendants who were brought in by amendment of the Doe provisions. And so that's seamless in that the original Heliotrope case that had the Doe Amendment was never dismissed. So it continued... even while the second case directed at at J.P. Morgan and CLR and some other defendants also
I have a question.
Proceeded.
What's the, you know, if you were to say the time period, when does the time period begin, according to you, that the heliotrope tolling covers, and when does it end? Does it begin when Morgan is brought in, or does it begin when the case is originally filed?
No, it's when Morgan comes
in.
But there's sufficient time because, of, as we indicated in our brief, the calculation of the time, even assuming that Judge Below was correct about the July 26, 1999 date as the start of the accrual of the cause of action for starting a statute of limitations, the Doe Amendment was made early enough that there was enough time left over at the end after our clients opted out to file and be timely. And the and Morgan doesn't does not contend otherwise. They understand and they agree on that point, that calculation. The issue is only whether or not the Heliotrope case actually does provide tolling, and I had hoped to be able to address why I think it is, but I know the court is familiar with our brief. And that if there are other questions.
Is there anything outside of the brief that you wanted to add?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think not. I think we've covered adequately those issues, and I'll be, if there's anything left at time of rebuttal, I'll answer that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Now Mr. Wasmuth can answer my question.
And the question of, is there any case law that discusses whether or not the tolling ends upon the opt-out?
Yeah.
There are cases that discuss the issue, such as the Linerboard case they submitted and talked about in their Rule 28 letter, but there seem to be lacking case law where that issue is determinative, where it really matters whether the opt-out is or the tolling ends when the party requests opting out or the court orders opting out. Let me talk about
one. Isn't it odd? Because, I mean, opt-out is a right that somebody has. And I can imagine, perhaps in a circumstance like this case, where it might not be clear if you're even in a proposed class definition, the court might say, yes, you're in the class, and now I'm letting you opt out so that you don't have to be in it. Or the court might say, I don't have to rule on this because as far as I'm concerned, you're not even within the class definition anyway, and therefore it'd be a meaningless act to opt out. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
sure.
Because one of the things the other side is arguing is the Southwire and the others simply didn't fit within the class definition of the heliotrope litigation.
Well, I think the reality of what happened in our case was we requested to opt out and the court ordered the opt out. So there was certainly no determination by the California court that I don't need to look at this because you're not in the class. That just didn't happen. They approved the opt out. Why?
A typical part of California procedure, do you happen to know?
I honestly don't know. But I think what's important as far as calculating the date is you have to look at this thinking about class action tolling. Think about it from the perspective of the defendant. What are they on notice of? What are they on notice of as far as the potential for class action remedy? In this case, they don't know if anything's changed until the settlement's approved and the opt-outs are approved. Up until that time, all of that can change. The settlement can be renegotiated. Southwire or any other opting out party asking to opt out can change their minds. So they don't know about the potential scope of what's at issue until, in fact, the court enters an order. That's why you have to look at the order date, not the request date, for determining the opt-out for when tolling in.
Yeah. Help me out here, because your position seems to me to be that in our circuit, at any rate, a plaintiff who's invoking equitable estoppel need not show that it exercised diligence in seeking to uncover claims.
That's correct.
Is there a limit to this proposition?
No.
What,
well, the limiting.
If there is, what is it? I mean, can a plaintiff lengthen a statute of limitation by sticking its head in the sand?
No. The question you have to ask, I think, is, it needs to be answered, is at what point is there a route to the truth? And so to say, well, couldn't you, you have all these lawyers in this room, couldn't you investigate? There's nothing to investigate. We have no, Pathwire has no subpoena power.
Well, all isn't the question, you know, an objective one, when does evidence available without subpoena power, if you will, when does publicly available evidence come to light that a particular party might have violated the laws? and thus perhaps their efforts to conceal this have now come to,
right.
to a halt.
That's precisely the test. It is a reasonable test. You know, and not
it's
only
an
that.
Objective test,
it's an objective
test, which is why the subjective
right.
actions of the plaintiff can't
right.
affect
it's an,
it.
It's an objective test, and especially at a summary judgment stage, it needs to be incontrovertible. And what we lack here is facts from which someone could say it is incontrovertible that Southwire should have known the basis for an antitrust claim prior to the unsealing of the Sumitomo complaint in August of 1999. Judge Wood, you make, I think, what is the best point here dealing with summary judgment, that is, no one sued Morgan. The whole world was suing Sumitomo. There was no lack of willing plaintiffs and willing plaintiffs' lawyers looking for someone to sue and billions of dollars of losses, and no one sues Morgan.
But is anyone reading the newspapers? I mean, take today. Anyone who reads any newspapers and sees the name Spitzer in any way, shape, or form attached to any company, surely, you know, those lawyers are
and they're
taking dives out of windows, I suppose, but stopping at the library.
Well, there may be, that depends, I suppose, on what's being reported. And what was being reported about Morgan was, if you look at the actual articles, especially the ones that the district court relied on, there at a special appendix, a separate appendix page, 552 to 79, what they're talking about is Morgan made some really bad loans. Morgan took on a lot of risk. Morgan might not get paid back. They're not saying Morgan was a willing conspirator in manipulating the price of copper.
But isn't there a principle on the other side of this that says you don't need to know the precise legal theory under which you're going to proceed? If you know somebody has hurt you, you have an obligation to go forward, and of course the statute of limitations, well, the antitrust statute gives you 4 years. There are other statutes of limitations for other theories. RICO, you know, has a similar statute of limitations, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got to look into it. You don't need to be so precise.
Right. Well, I think that's true, but I'm not
so
sure.
Why not? The July 23rd, 1996 AP release that the district court chose to use as kind of the pivotal point.
Well, I don't think that's showing that Morgan, there's any basis for anyone in Southwire's position to believe that there's a basis for saying Morgan is a knowing conspirator in manipulating prices. And what the district court focused on, frankly, I think, was this concept of inquiry notice, which I think is the wrong concept. The issue is the one Your Honor
pointed
out.
You're saying that lawyers are way behind the reporters, are you not?
Well, I think the reporters
have to spell it out before the lawyers catch on? Is that
well, I think there has to be a route, like the way I put it, a route to the truth. And what's lacking here is an incontrovertible route to the truth, a basis to sue Morgan for an antitrust violation prior to the time Sumitomo spills the beans in August of 1999.
We have to assume the lawyers are a little suspicious of these things?
Well, so there's suspicion, and then there's having a Rule 11 basis for an antitrust claim.
Were you aware of Morgan's confidentiality agreement at that time?
No. I don't think there's any record that we were.
Okay. Were you aware of their refusal to participate in congressional hearings at that time?
I'm frankly uncertain that that's in the record. I mean, what we've had is the affidavit of some of our, of at least one of our executives who was deposed, who said we were monitoring the class action litigation. We were members of those classes for the most part, and we were reading the newspapers trying to figure out what was going on. But we have no, we can't knock on the door of Morgan and say, give us all your records. We want to conduct an investigation. We would have no ability to do that, and therefore no ability outside of context of monitoring the class action litigation and monitoring the media of knowing what's going on until someone like Sumitomo comes forward and spills the beans.
This probably puts you on the spot too much, but in retrospect, in utter retrospect, do you know what you would have done differently?
I'm not, frankly, Your Honor, no. I mean, it would be one thing, I think, that if there were some people suing Morgan.
No, you don't know, or no, you wouldn't have done anything
differently? No, I don't think we would have done anything any differently as far as suing Morgan, because frankly, I don't know what more we could have done. No one was suing Morgan. Morgan had hidden the facts. They carefully manipulated the press to hide the facts. And no one was suing Morgan. So I'm at a loss to know what Southwire could have done differently to be sort of be the first. And I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Barenboim, yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
If it pleases the court, first, very briefly, let me respond to two points raised on appellant's argument. First, the liner board case directly addresses the argument in this case as to whether tolling ends when the opt-out is submitted or when the order is asserted, and that was plainly an issue in that case. Liner board goes our way and relies on two other cases cited in liner board, the Real Monte case and the Toasty case, for that proposition. Second, we cite in our brief on page 35 the Bell case, which is the California case, which says that the California court has no discretion to deny an opt-out request, so we could address that.
But what about my situation? When you integrate the argument that, and I'm sorry if I'm blending together a little bit yours with Morgan's, but when there is some question as to whether somebody actually falls within a proposed revised class definition, and you often get this problem if you're working on a settlement class definition so that you don't have some nice little sequence of class definition and then things moving on, you could easily imagine a court needing to clarify the legal status of a party. Are you in or out of the class? And if you're in the class, then you have the right to decide whether you want to stay in, not up to the court, as you correctly say. But if you're not in the class, then they don't have anything to say to you.
But
doesn't it imply, actually, that they were in the class? Doesn't your opt-out argument imply that they weren't?
No, I don't think so, Judge. In an opt-out situation, if there is a lack of clarity as to whether the class member is in the class, and the class member submits an opt-out, the class member is saying, I do not want to be associated with this class, even if I am in the class. And if I'm not in the class, then I get the same result. Either way, the class member is saying, I want nothing to do with this class action anymore. And at that point, it's unreasonable for that class member to say, but nevertheless, I want tolling.
Well, but, you know, the appellants argue that the order dismissing the Heliotrop case without prejudice did not definitively deny class certification, and that the district judge explicitly stated that a class could be certified later in the course of the case. So wasn't Sumitomo on notice then that the class certification issue was still at play?
No, Your Honor, for the following reasons. First of all, the order of the California court under California law was an order that was appealable, and it could have been appealed by class counsel in Heliotrope, and it was not.
You're talking about the Bell case.
No, I'm talking about it's the Gruntner case, I think. I have to find it in the brief.
Okay.
But we cite in our brief the case that says that the order entered by the Heliotrope court denying class certification on the grounds that the class was not ascertainable was an appealable order, irrespective of the fact that there was subsequent oral argument. That order was never appealed. At that point, it becomes unreasonable for a class member who's been told by a judge that the judge cannot even figure out who's in the class. It becomes unreasonable at that point for the class member to rely on the possibility that some point later in the proceeding a class might come into existence.
But it wasn't just a hypothesis. I mean, the court had gone much further than that. I mean, certainly if the court hadn't said all the things that Judge Rovner just rehearsed, you'd be absolutely right. But when a court is saying, I'm not done with this yet, let's have some argument, let's work more on class certification, a party would assume at its peril that no class was going to result.
No, I think
it's not like there's just silence.
No, I think at that point the party has to proceed at its peril because it has no idea whether there will be a class later or if there is a class
later.
Well,
the defendant has to continue preparing as though it may be a class it's defending against as well, though, is my point.
But
there's
the
peril on both sides, perhaps.
But the class action tolling rules are designed to judge the reasonableness of the class member in relying on the continued class.
I understand that, and I'm just saying I think there's notice here. Let me go to a different aspect of the class, if we can. I'm sorry we have to bounce around so much. But one of the premises, it seems to me, that lies behind the district judge's decision not to toll for the heliotrope class action is that it's a Cartwright Act claim, basically. It's a state antitrust claim. That seems to me inconsistent with the concept of a claim that's reflected in the Supreme Court's decisions in Maurice against the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and in the Matsushita against Epstein case, both of which involve a pattern. The first is an antitrust case, the second a securities case, where there's a state-based claim first, then a federal claim. And the Supreme Court has been clear as can be that the full faith and credit statute applies to the federal claim, even though there was no jurisdiction in the state court to adjudicate the federal claims. Matsushita is actually a class action settlement case. I read those cases to say the concept of a claim itself, what is the claim in the state case, is one that comes from the principles of, you know, whatever the jurisdiction's res judicata tests are, whatever the jurisdiction's preclusion tests are. And in that sense, I think Justice in Maurice and Matsushita, had Heliotrope come to a conclusion and had Southwire stayed in, you'd be here arguing preclusion, I guarantee you. You'd be arguing saying they can't come along and bring a federal antitrust claim.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure we would be arguing that.
Well, I think you would if you read Maurice.
If the claim could not have been brought in the first case, it's not clear that it would be precluded.
Let me tell you what Justice O'Connor had to say about that, though. She says, under 1738, state issue preclusion law may promote the goal in relitigation. We reject the idea that 1738 holds as a matter of federal law, that the plaintiff can bring state law claims initially in state court only at the cost. I mean, that's exactly the issue in Maurice.
No, I understand that, Judge Wood.
Respectfully,
first, to be clear about the record here, Judge Crabb's opinion in the Sumitomo case did not rely on that proposition. Judge Crabb's opinion in the Sumitomo case, as opposed to the Morgan case, relied on the proposition that tolling ends when the trial court denies class certification and that you cannot stack. So we don't need that argument to affirm Judge Crabb in the Sumitomo case.
No, but why shouldn't the plaintiffs be able to stack rolling tolling periods when the second class action wasn't used merely to relitigate a previously rejected certification issue?
Well, I think, Judge, for the reason Judge Wood just pointed out, if you're going to view the first case as a case that litigates all claims that are or could have been brought and even claims that could not have been brought, like the Sherman Act, if you're going to view it that way, then Loeb is the same case as Heliotrope. In
but
both
that only
situations,
happens when there's a resolution of the first case. And, of course, we have the opt-out circumstance, which is different.
No, Your Honor. In this case, what you have is an unsuccessful attempt at class certification in Heliotrope, followed by an unsuccessful attempt at class certification in Loeb. And Southwire is trying to string those two together to extend the tolling period twice, stack those two tolling periods,
mm-hmm.
in order to save his claims. And what that leads to in this situation would be, hypothetically, you could have class action after class action after class action, each of which repeatedly tolls the statute of limitations for the individual parties, resulting in the statutory period ending 4 years later and having tolling the entire time. Then you would begin again for individuals who bring suits, and you would have the additional 4 years of the statute, and you could have suits being brought 8, 9, 10, 11 years after the fact, which is what's happening in this case. And so the anti-stacking cases, Bosch in the First Circuit, hold that that is an abuse of the tolling rules because it results in the defendants having to litigate cases years after the fact.
But the Supreme Court's never addressed this, right? They've got American Pipe and Crown Cork and so on, but they've never...
The Supreme Court has not addressed the stacking point. Your Honors, I see my time is going, and let me just raise one other point, as Judge Wood referred to early on. The premise of Southwire's arguments here is that they are a member of both the heliotrope class and the lobe class. Crown Cork makes clear that in order to get class action tolling, the defendant needs to be on notice of the generic identity and number of class members and size of the litigation. In both heliotrope and lobe, the district court found that the class was not ascertainable, that you could not find out who the class members were. In that circumstance, where you couldn't possibly know who to send Eisen notice to, you would not know who would be bound by a judgment based on those class definitions.
How do you know that in B2 classes?
The B2 classes aren't opt-out classes.
I know that, but I'm saying tolling applies in B2 classes.
That's true.
So the arguments you're making about notice to the defendant and ascertainability of people and so forth would either suggest that there's no tolling in B2 classes or that those elements are not as important as you say they are.
No, I think in a B3 class like this situation, what Crown Cork is suggesting is that defendants should be on notice of the liability it faces, which you can only determine based on the number of people in the class and where they are in the distribution system. And here you had two judges who said, I'm looking at this class and I cannot possibly figure out who's in the class. In that circumstance, if you would not know who would be bound for res judicata principles, how do you know who to give tolling effect to? How do we know today that Southwire was a member of either of these classes? We don't. Judge Crabb could not figure it out. Judge Jones and Heliotrope could not figure it out. And indeed, to the extent one could figure out who was in the heliotrope class, it plainly did not include Southwire. The heliotrope class was a class of end users. If you can understand anything about the heliotrope class...
Well, eventually it got clarified that it was end users. I mean, at the beginning it said people who bought copper-based products or something of the sort. It was...
Copper-based products,
right.
Exactly right. Copper-based products, not copper. Heliotrope buys copper and makes it into wire. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Did you want to add anything, given your friends on the other side an extra moment?
Only, Your Honor, that the principal basis of Judge Crabb's ruling below that class certification class tolling ends when class certification is denied by the trial court is the rule that exists in just about every case that I've seen. And a contrary rule that suggests that so long as class certification is in play or might happen or is still subject to consideration, I think is a rule that would be extremely hard to apply as a practical matter. Whereas the bright line rule that we have now, class certification ends when class tolling ends when class certification is denied, is an easy to apply rule and should be applied here. And that was the basis of Judge Crabb's decision below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wendell.
Yeah.
Yep,
it
throw it in.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Jim Wendell's for J.P. Morgan & Co. First, I'd like to address the issue of when the four-year period begins to run, or when the alleged Sherman Act violation accrues. The Supreme Court in the Zenith Radio case says that a Clayton Act, which is the operative statute here, claim accrues when a defendant commits an act that injures a plaintiff's business. And this court has applied somewhat of a discovery rule on top of that to say that the four-year period begins to run when a plaintiff discovers that it has been injured. Not necessarily who has injured it or how much, That is what the four-year period is for. The four-year period is an investigative period. It's a very long period of time. It is intended to give the potential plaintiffs a lot of opportunity to go out and to search for facts and to put together its complaint within a four-year period.
But wait a minute. Let's back up here because, of course, as you know, in the law of conspiracy, the wrong itself is continuing as long as the conspiracy is underway. And we don't have Sumitomo announcing to the public these immense losses of $1.8 billion until June 13, 1996, and a little while thereafter. The district judge seizes on this July 23, 1996 date. Those don't strike me as hugely different. And then at that point, your case is really all about putting this class action stuff to one side, the equitable estoppel argument. Equitable estoppel, not equitable tolling. Because the Supreme Court certainly recognizes that as a doctrine, too, Zenith Radio to the contrary notwithstanding. That's not really to the contrary. It's just an independent principle that comes in. And so I think it would be helpful for me, anyway, if you would address particularly the false statements to the regulators and that sort of thing. And it would also help me if you would address what you think the diligent investigator could have found that was not covered by your confidentiality agreements, that was in the public domain?
First of all, on the latter question first, starting a four-year period from July of 1996, when plaintiffs certainly knew that they had been injured by probably the largest event in the copper industry in the last 50 years, if you start the four-year period
then... But maybe
not
necessarily injured by Morgan. You need to know that a particular defendant has injured you.
Correct. By August 1999, well within the four-year period, the Sumitomo complaint was filed.
But you're making an assumption that the same principle applies to equitable estoppel as applies to equitable tolling, namely that there's a start date for the statute of limitations, and then the event becomes known sometime before the statute is run, and you only have the balance left. That would certainly be the case if we were dealing with equitable tolling. But the law seems to indicate with equitable estoppel that the wrongdoer can't benefit in that way from the concealment and the actual 4 years starts running from the moment of revelation.
Or just stated differently, that the period is told from the actual accrual date in July 96 up until August
99. Okay. Well,
To address the substance, I completely understand your Honor's substantive concerns. To show equitable estoppel, the cases in this district, in this circuit, starting with Singletary, show that you really need active steps by the defendant for the purpose of preventing plaintiffs from suing.
Right, and
that's
why don't we have a genuine issue of material fact? I certainly understand what you would argue on your side, but it looks to me like there are facts that your opponents are arguing that would show that precise standard you just articulated. Active steps to conceal wrongdoing.
If I just might add, because it would be very helpful to me, Morgan was very aggressive in its public information control and made a deliberate and concerted effort to keep information about its connection to Sumitomo's bad acts hidden from the public. I know that you call your policy conservative or whatever, but to me, tight-lipped, you know, might have been a better description. And I can understand a company's desire to keep negative press spin in check, but there's a fine line, it seems, between reputation control and deception. And I, for one, I'm just not as convinced as Judge Kraft was that you were on the right side of the line. And I'm also secondarily somewhat troubled by the fact that you signed a confidentiality agreement with an employee 2 years after that employee was terminated. It's oddly suspicious conduct. So that's a lot, I know.
I'll try to do it all in 2 minutes. I'll try to stack the questions up. And no problem at all. Appreciate the opportunity. On the Keith Murphy issue, he resigned from the company. He was a managing director. He had a number of unvested options. He had an extended period of discussion with him until an agreement was reached. The 30B6 witness, Diane Genova, on behalf of J.P. Morgan, described, in fact, that the confidentiality provisions, the cooperation provisions, the issues relating to stock, his status as a managing director, all of those terms that she was aware of in the agreement were standard procedural, were not customary. And the issue is here is whether there is any material fact, not just speculation from the factual record, but anything actually in the record that would permit you to infer that somehow this agreement was so out of the ordinary or so improper that there should be some inference that this was, as plaintiffs say, to quiet Keith Murphy. The only evidence is through Morgan's 30B6 witness, and she testified that the provisions she was aware of were in fact customary. On the issue of the press control,
is it also customary to wait 2 years to enter into it?
That is a long period of time. I'm not sure she was ever asked to give a view on that. I would imagine that probably would not be normal, but still, even if we assume it's abnormal, why does that necessitate or lead to a bad conclusion? Mr. Murphy gave significant testimony to the regulators and to certain private plaintiffs here. It wasn't as if he was silent. In fact, he was repeatedly deposed, and he had all of his files produced to the regulators. They were able to review those files. They were able to ask him questions about the files. And at the end of the day, the market regulators, the SIB in the UK and the CFTC here in the United States, determined not to bring any actions against Morgan for market manipulation. They had all of the documents. They had all of the basis. They had all of information from Sumitomo, which they were investigating simultaneously. And they had the ability, much better than anyone here, to come to a different conclusion if they had, in fact, believed that any Morgan witness was lying. In fact, they didn't. And we had numerous witnesses go in. We produced lots and lots of documents. Certainly, they could have had suspicions at the outset, but they investigated this thoroughly. And all we're left with on this record is plaintiffs, we submit, completely unsupported statements that this testimony was false and it was significant. And if they had known anything different, they would have taken affirmative steps to inquire or bring suit against Morgan.
Maybe you can then turn to the other question I asked, which is really troubling me, and that is, given all the confidentiality, and by definition, those are things that are not in the public domain. You didn't want them to be in the public domain. They were not in the public domain. Without subpoena power, you couldn't get them. What could the diligent person have found about antitrust violations? I would turn it around and say, you know, the companies that have been paying millions of dollars of criminal fines in the vitamins cartel, as far as I know, haven't been indicted on securities violations for the same thing. I mean, they're just different things. So,
sure. First, let's just go back to June and July 1996. There was substantial press about Sumitomo's losses, the alleged inflation of copper prices for purchases of copper like plaintiffs. This must have been a huge event. This was money potentially taken right out of their pocket. July 18, the first page of the Wall Street Journal, the first sentence of the article. Several big U.S. banks, including Chase Manhattan and J.P. Morgan & Co., made huge loans to Japan's Sumitomo Corp. that were used to finance the company's ill-fated copper trading operations.
But does that make the antitrust part of your brain light up, or does that make you think, gee, maybe these banks are going to lose a lot of money because they made bad loans?
The next week, there's an article, again, front page of the Wall Street Journal, the Commodity Future and Trading Commission, which is actually vested with the authority to investigate market manipulation, full square, right in the wheelhouse of the antitrust laws, are investigating whether Japan used financing from J.P. Morgan in an attempt, quote, in an attempt to manipulate the copper market. It is front and center in these articles for anyone who is reading them that there are potentially gigantic losses, an extended period of manipulation, financing by U.S. banks, and a federal government investigation into exactly that issue. So if you start the 4 years then, well within the 4 years...
Is there anything else other than these couple of newspaper articles?
There are others. There are the amount of the loans, $400 million. There are allegations that the the loans were, quote, disguised as derivative transactions in order to potentially conceal them from the individuals within Sumitomo who were monitoring internal controls. There's a quote from a copper specialist: "This is the strangest kind of commodity derivative I've ever seen."
Well, as you go through all of this, and you see all of the disagreements with the various characterizations of responses to the media and other investigatory bodies, et cetera, don't they seem like disputes regarding material facts that can't be resolved on summary judgment?
When you add, though, the Sumitomo complaint, which comes in August 99, that is within the four-year period. It is within the time...
But as I said, that doesn't matter if we're talking about equitable estoppel.
Yes, correct. If the
you
period,
agree with that.
Yes,
okay. It,
and very much our position, as Judge Crabb found, is that the period of time begins to run in July 96, number one,
and
that equitable...
And if we thought it began to run in August of 99...
We wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be here, and if we thought we were not dealing with at least issues about Morgan's behavior that might need resolution on the fraudulent concealment slash equitable estoppel ground, presumably wouldn't be here either if for
correct.
Some reason that was clear. So we just have to decide whether we think there's enough here that a reasonable person could see it either way.
That's correct. And just to put equitable estoppel and accrual, conceptually they're just slightly different. And on the accrual point,
right, that's
and if
I
you
put them
if you put equitable estoppel aside, the Sumitomo complaint does come in within the four-year period. So to answer Your Honor's question, that is what they would have investigated during the four-year period. That's
well,
how
no,
the process is supposed to work.
They couldn't have investigated internal materials to Sumitomo. Sumitomo doesn't
when
file
the
its complaint with materials that are not available to these other plaintiffs.
Correct, but that complaint is publicized in August of 99, and it contains verbatim quotes from numerous Morgan internal emails and everything.
Right, there's a wealth.
So the issue, I think, does devolve to equitable estoppel. And just to conclude briefly on that, I know that lunch hour is upon us. The different items of conduct, no evidence of an active attempt to prevent plaintiffs from suing. The classic equitable estoppel case is where a potential defendant, will actually say to a plaintiff, "Don't worry, you don't have to sue. We're not going to plead a statute of limitations defense." We don't have that here. There's no inference of intent, and as Mr. Wozma stated in his oral argument, even if they had known certain of the facts, they wouldn't have done anything differently. So the causation or
But his point was that we still wouldn't have had enough to file a complaint that would survive sanction. I think you're using that information a little differently.
Well, they do have to show, though, that this information, if disclosed, would have made a difference, and we submit that they have.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. I'm going to give you your minute and a half, each of you. Are you going to follow?
Make a couple of points. One is, what we're really talking about as far as Morgan and equitable estoppel, I think, is drawing inferences from facts. I mean, you can look at these facts and say, well, Morgan's trying to be conservative and keep its name out of the press. And also look at these facts, I would submit, and conclude that they're trying to bury the evidence and keep everything sealed up and locked away and run out the four-year clock. I mean, I point out one of the articles, Special Appendix page 561, is one of those 1996 articles. Observers also question whether the U.S. banks fully investigated Sumitomo's reasons for requesting such a complicated structure for the loans. That's not saying Morgan knew something culpable about the structural loans, saying that Morgan itself was duped. Say make one point about heliotrope and stacking. Heliotrope, we're not stacking one unsuccessful class action on top of another. Heliotrope was not a lack of success. Heliotrope was a success. The judge said, "I want to have a class with everyone who's important." That's his words. And in fact, there was a class, and Southwire was in it. So when asking to put together some tolling from Loeb and Heliotrope, we're not talking about stacking or relitigating a failed class certification. There was no failed class certification.
How can we have a rule, though, that relies on what the the judge said, well, I hope we get a class sometime in the future.
I think there's more than that.
You can have a rule based on
that. No, but if you read the transcript, it says he was concerned about the fringes. I don't think Sumitomo's lawyers could have left that courtroom that day and thought, we dodged the class action bullet. And therefore, under American Pipe and Crown Cork and Ceiling, they had reason to know of what was at issue and the scope, and therefore the balancing of the considerations that apply in tolling means that litigation efficiencies outweigh other considerations, and tolling should have continued past that point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. 1.5 minutes.
I started, so I guess it's appropriate I finished. Real quickly, 4 points. Number one, whatever the question is about membership in the class of Heliotrope vis-a-vis Sumitomo and Southwire, Morgan conceded that the ASARCO plaintiffs were all members of the Heliotrope class. That's not an issue here. Second of all, with respect to Mr. Murphy's agreement, Your Honor, I believe, Judge Rogner, you put your finger right on it. What was different about that agreement was that it came 2 years after he was resigned. It's not the circumstance that he went voluntarily. He was threatened and he left. But that wasn't exactly a voluntary resignation. Third, the article, he called it an article, counsel for Morgan recited words from an AP release. As you know from our briefs, there's no evidence in the record that that release ever made it into any newspapers. The way AP works is it distributes all kinds of things to its member newspapers and radio stations and such, but they choose whether or not to publish it. There's no evidence that that was ever published, and of course, the statement about the CFTC investigating the banks was immediately denied, and that denial appeared in the Wall Street Journal, certainly a journal, a publication that the plaintiffs reviewed. And finally, this is a situation, as you all will recall from the Loeb decision, this is a situation where there was not face-to-face dealing between our clients and Sumitomo and J.P. Morgan. Consequently, equitable estoppel applies in a context that's very different from the circumstance where the plaintiff and the defendant dealt face-to-face. And the way in which Morgan would dissuade people from bringing a suit is not through face-to-face communications, but by the way in which they managed the press, because they knew that's how they were going to communicate to the plaintiffs that they ought not to sue. Unless there are any other questions, thank you very much.
All right. Well, gosh, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. It was a very interesting and enlightening argument, and we appreciate that. And we will take the case under advisement. All right, and everyone have a good trip back to wherever it is you're going.
Thank you.